Coming up on this episode.
Like on our ward, the first time the crash bell got called, you know, I was shitting myself. I was like, what the hell do I do? Like, the first time you see a patient alone, your anxiety is going to be here. And the 10th time it's going to be here. And the 100th time it's going to be here. I was shocked. It just like, I left on Friday and I was like, wow, I'm like genuinely sad right now, you know? Mm. Like these conversations do have an effect on you. You know, even talking about it now, I can feel myself a little bit emotional. Mm-hmm. The transition from finally your medical student to doctor is that it literally goes like this. I said something along the lines of, do you want me to tell you how I really feel, or do you want me to tell you something just to make you feel better? You know, I try to have a bit of fun engagement when I'm talking to someone on the phone, just out of politeness, nothing else really. And yeah, it rubs me the wrong way when people are so just like rude or miserable or short. You know, we're all working towards the same goal. I'm not calling you for fun to waste your time. I'm calling you because I'm concerned and I have a question, and yeah, you're the specialist in this field, right?
Welcome to the MedConceptions podcast. The following is a conversation with Nazir Karma. Nazir is a foundation year doctor in London. He's also known for his YouTube channel, Karma Medic. In this channel, he has over 1 million subscribers, and he talks about productivity, education, and lifestyle. In this podcast, he shares his experience from a medical student to becoming a doctor, the ups and downs of it. We also touch upon mental health, multitasking, and workplace bullying. Overall, I think it's a very genuine conversation. And if you take in mind the fact that this is probably the first proper conversation I've had with Nazir, I think it comes to show what an approachable and humble character he has. I really enjoyed filming this episode, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
So, how you been? You okay?
Yes, I'm good. I'm very, very good. Excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a true pleasure. And to be honest, I'm very humbled by the fact that you actually like accepted to come.
I did. And the story of how you invited me on the podcast, that's pretty fun.
Yeah, the fact that I didn't know that you spoke Greek, and then, yeah, I love that.
Yeah. You came and found me in the cafeteria. And you were like, hey, come on the podcast. I was like, yeah, sure. Send me an email. Here we are.
You know, Simone was like, I think he's like, oh, you should go. She kind of nudged me.
This was your idea.
Yeah. Nice. You need that nudge in the beginning.
You do. It's true.
But yeah. So how does it feel? Start with the first question. How does it feel being called doctor?
Oof. Even today, to be honest, I was writing in the documentation, elderly care ward round, Dr. Karma. And every time I write it, it feels a bit strange. Because, you know, you're so used to calling other people doctor and referring to your consultant or your registrar or whatever as doctor. But when you write Dr. Karma and it's like, oh, yeah, that's actually me. My name is going to be there as the responsible doctor. It's interesting. It feels really good. I'm still getting used to it.
Yeah. Do you feel like you earned it? But like when people, yeah, I don't know. Like with me, being I'm fourth year medical student now. So being a sixth year medical student, then in the blink of an eye, just turns like you're a doctor. I just feel like there's so much responsibility under that doctor title.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the word that I was going to use when you said, you know, you must feel like you've earned it.
Yeah.
What I was going to say is that you feel like you've earned the responsibility to be a doctor, right? But you still have that responsibility. It's not like you get there and you've earned it and now your job is done. Just go be a doctor.
Yeah.
You've earned the responsibility of being a doctor, which comes with a lot of, in my opinion, like weight and emotional feeling and seriousness. It carries a lot of weight with it. And,
yeah.
You know, and that transition does happen very, very fast. You'll be a final year medical student in no time. You'll be doing your SJT and your final exams and whatever. And then literally you get a couple weeks off or 2 months or whatever. And you show up on day one and it's like, hey, you're a doctor now. Go do X, Y, and Z. So yeah, happens pretty fast.
Do you feel like you are a doctor? Like the things that you do every day? Are they like, because I've heard like from a lot of people, like, oh, you're a glorified secretary. That's what FY1s are.
Yeah,
and it kind of disappoints me because I'm like, I don't want to be a glorified secretary. I want to have, how's that?
Yeah. I definitely get what you mean. I think, you know, my friends ask me this question all the time, and my response has been as of late, now I really feel like I am a doctor. I'm like making decisions, I'm seeing patients on my own, I'm thinking about, you know, what underlying diagnoses they might have, drug treatments that I can give, implementing those treatments, seeing how they make an effect, what kind of effect they have, mm-hmm. monitoring that through bloods, through their clinical condition. And I feel like I'm a doctor. And one of the things that makes me the most feel like I'm a doctor is the sort of difficult and heavy conversations that you have with next of kin. So with family members, with the children of the patient, with friends, family, those heavy conversations when, you know, there's really serious things happening with the patient, those make me feel the most like a doctor, because I feel like I'm in a position of real responsibility and real importance in conveying certain information to patients and their family. And that's for me what's felt the most like I am a doctor now.
I know you've been on a geriatric ward, right? And that
yes.
you just finished today. So
yeah, I just finished today.
Congratulations about that.
Thank you. Thanks. First rotation done.
First rotation successful. Seen you do that constantly. Like, look on
yeah.
I like that.
Nice. And I knock wood a lot. It's a way of externalizing like the luck that's involved in something, you know?
Yeah.
Just like, oh, touch wood. Someone's watching over me. Someone's helping. The luck is on my side somehow. I don't know. That's the general idea behind it.
I like it. So when you said heavy conversation, I was thinking geriatric ward, put the things together, palliative. So I was thinking, mm-hmm. so your father, your grandfather, mm-hmm. your wife is mm-hmm. going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you mean?
Oh, like in terms of the types of conversations yeah. that we have? So it's not quite that short and blunt.
No, of course, but like yeah. the context.
But the main idea, when you're palliating someone, which means that you are stopping the active treatment that you're giving the patient, and you're moving towards a approach of keeping them comfortable, pain-free, symptom-free, and just trying to have whatever remaining life they have be as comfortable as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So you're stopping things like IV antibiotics, blood tests, you know, giving them oxygen, etc., a lot of the time, and you're focusing on no pain, no agitation, no symptoms. And so the conversation that you tend to have with next of kin is helping them understand that, you know, medicine can only do so much. And at this point in time, we think that we may be causing more harm than good by continuing to have active medical management. And we think that it would be in the patient's best interests if we move towards a palliative care approach.
Mm.
That's kind of where the majority of the conversation is. And because a lot of people don't understand that.
Mm.
They think, you know, you're in the hospital, you have all these drugs, you have all these doctors. Like,
there should be a solution.
Just fix my family. Yeah.
Yeah.
There must be a way. Just keep them alive, even if it's for one more day. I'm getting a bit emotional talking about it. Yeah, a lot of people just want to keep them alive for one more day, for one more week. Just keep trying. But a lot of the time, that's not the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the conversation is about most.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure it's tough, and it's tough because you're a foundation year doctor, and you're expected to do this. So I guess it's that thing that you're thrown into the middle of the ocean, and you kind of have to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it depends on the kind of rotation you're on. You know, I'm sure a lot of F1s in surgical specialties probably have to deal with acutely very unwell patients and trying to manage them maybe on their own when there isn't as much senior support. Mm. And then on a ward like Jerry's, the difficult thing for the F1 to do maybe these types of conversations with patients and their family. It depends. It's a very varied experience.
If you want, do you have any stories that kind of like have any patient encounters? I'm sure you've had many.
Too many. Yeah, a lot. Like, I won't talk about anything specific, but a lot of these conversations, you know, I still remember the patient's names. Like, I remember the family members' names. I remember what the conversation was like, you know, who was, and how different people handled it. You know, people dealing with grief and with coming to terms that their family member may pass away or will pass away. People deal with it in very different ways, you know. Some people are much more understanding and sort of informed about this whole palliative care thing. Other people are very much in denial. And, you know, people's emotions run really wild, really high. So there's been a lot of interesting conversations, a lot of very meaningful ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that I remember really well. But, you know, we won't go into detail about
that. How does that affect you, though? Because I guess it's a job. Like, you do your 8 to 5, And then you have to go back home and go see your girlfriend, go see your sister. And
Yeah. I remember a couple of weeks ago, I left work on Friday and I was in the car and I called my girlfriend and I just said to her, like, I feel so sad. And the reason I felt sad was because over the last 2 days, Thursday, Friday, I'd had 5 conversations with 5 different families about end of life and palliative care and stopping, you know, active treatment. And it just, like, I left on Friday and I was like, wow, I'm like genuinely sad right now, you know, like these conversations do have an effect on you. You know, even talking about it now, I can feel myself a little bit emotional. And I feel like on a day-to-day basis, you just deal with it. You know, you do what you need to do. You document in the notes, you go home and everything's okay. But somewhere deep down, it is all there. I think it'll take some time to kind of learn how to manage those emotions properly over the long term. Yeah, some stuff does come home with you for sure.
Do you think, I don't know, I'm thinking exercise. Like for me, I think exercise is one thing that kind of, cardiovascular exercise, so like cardio.
Okay.
So going for a run and clearing your mind and stuff like that, that helps me. Like I definitely haven't had the same intense experience as you have, but I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, exercise is obviously great and I feel like it was such a core coping mechanism for me in medical school with being stressed and overwhelmed and having too much to do on my to-do list and whatever. I feel like now, since I've started working, I don't have that much that similar feeling of being extremely overwhelmed. My to-do list is very long. I've taken quite a significant step back from the YouTube channel and almost all my time is focused on medicine-related things. And so I've also like started playing a lot of video games by myself, seeing my friends a lot more, going out. And so the gym has kind of been replaced for me with those activities. Mm. I don't have the need to go run my heart out and forget about what's on my head. But I miss the gym a lot. And I do want to go back, but it's not as, it's not like a necessary component of my day anymore. So it's harder to find time for it, I think, for sure.
So I think this is a good point for me to ask one of the questions that I really wanted to ask you.
Okay.
Because this is what I'm going through. Mm. And trying to balance everything.
Yes.
So just for some context, I'm sure very few of the subscribers don't know this, but you have a YouTube channel, a very successful YouTube channel. It's 1 million and going up subscribers. That's amazing. That needs hard work, dedication. So yeah. And then you also have got a long-term relationship, which I know from my experience as well that it's something that needs care. And it's like you kindle it and you grow
sure.
and it needs care constantly. You can't just leave and then be like, oh, I have a relationship and that's it.
Yeah, you can't take a break.
You can't take a break.
Yeah.
And then adding to that, you're a medical student. So you went through medical school doing this. I don't know, when did you start the YouTube channel?
I started medical school in 2017. So early 2018.
Yeah.
Somewhere there, maybe March.
And then you, like I've heard you talk about your exercise, which like... now you don't do it as often, but still. And then you got your social life. You want to see your friends. And so practical advice to me and anybody else struggling or how you feel about it. It doesn't have to be practical advice.
Yeah. I think how I felt at the time when I was doing all of that and how I feel now looking back on it are very, very different. I feel now looking back on it, I genuinely have no idea how I managed to do all those things that I was doing in a single day and keeping on track of, you know, all those different aspects of my life. I was just in such a, like a horse with the blinders on, you know, really tunnel vision focused on several goals and just making sure that they were done every day. But I genuinely don't, like thinking about it now, I don't know how I was able to do that on a daily basis for so long. I really don't know. Because now the idea of like using up every spare minute of my time to be productive and go to the gym, then see my friends, then work out, then edit a YouTube video, then whatever. Like it sounds crazy to me, you know? I'm like, I just want to relax. Like I want to have a bit more fun. I want to call up my friend, call up my girlfriend, just chat, you know, be more present in the moment.
Mm.
I think a lot of the time when I was running around in medical school, I was very much not present on in the moment, but focusing on what was the next step, what was the next thing I was going to do, and how I was going to achieve it. And I don't know. I didn't get stressed. I didn't get tired. I just like worked and slept very little. And it worked out. I don't know. As far as practical advice goes, I think you can break down what I did into smaller steps, and it's feasible and doable for a lot of people. I've talked about that extensively in my videos. And I think if you listen to those videos, it's not, there's no magic bullet. There's no secret sauce. You know, it's quite literally just like be very, very organized, manage your time extremely well, be disciplined, blah, blah, blah. There's no magic bullet to what I did. But yeah, it takes a lot of effort over time. I think over time is the difficult part. Doing any of these things for a short period of time is not that difficult, but doing it for years at a time is where I think a lot of people might struggle.
You were talking about this on Ali Abdal's podcast, and I remember you said, I know exactly how much time it takes for me to do a coffee.
Yeah.
and I know exactly how much time it takes for me to do tea. So I was like I just had a moment of realization and be like, wow, like, yeah. Like you were on it.
I was.
And the other thing that you said, which I want to start doing, which I love, is you say, like as a practical piece of advice, before you went to bed, I don't know if you still do it, I wanted to ask you about this, you would sit down and write what you have to do the next day.
Yeah.
So the night before, you just sit down, write down like what the plan's going to be for the next day. Something that I don't do and I have to start doing, because I think that's going to help a lot. Because you wake up and you're like, oh, now I do a program. It's like... Now it goes by.
I do still do that. And I think like one of my just overall big philosophies is just to make as few big decisions in the day as possible. I think decision fatigue is a very real thing. Like, should I eat this or should I eat that? Should I drink this? Should I drink that? What clothes should I wear? Should I take the bus? Should I take the car? Should I?
Now you wear scrubs.
And I wear scrubs, yeah. But I find that anywhere I can eliminate decision-making in my life, it makes my life so much easier. So making a small schedule before you go to sleep means that when you wake up, you don't have to think about what you're going to do today. Your little piece of paper is going to tell you what to do. And when you have something to do that you don't want to do, well, I've said to do a lot of times, but when you're doing something that you're not necessarily exciting about, like maybe you have to write an essay or study, having something tell you what to do is so much easier than sitting there and starting from a blank page. And I think it makes a very, very big difference.
I'm gonna implement it and get back to you.
Yeah, you should. Make a video about it.
Make a video about it, yeah. I don't know. I was thinking about making videos, which are quite different to podcasts.
Yeah.
I don't know if we'll... Maybe sometime.
You should.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely different skill. It's a different editing process, a different thinking and creative process. But they're both very fun.
I love teaching. So that's one thing that I love doing. So, I think I might like it.
Yeah, you should. You should try it. You've got nothing to lose.
That's true. How's the teaching with the medical students going on?
Oh, it's so good.
Talk to me about it.
I love my medical students. Oh, my God. I love them so much.
The UCL medical students, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're mostly UCL here.
Is UCL better? Like, be honest.
No comment.
Okay.
But yeah, the medical students are great. I mean, anytime someone is even a little bit keen to learn or to see things or to do things, it makes my life so much easier. And I love seeing that from people. It makes me excited about wanting to teach them. I love teaching people. And I love having medical students because I feel like I can give them the experience that I wanted when I was a medical student. You know, instead of them asking, hey, can I do this? Hey, can I do that? Or sitting in the corner, not being acknowledged by anyone. I can introduce myself. I can introduce them to the team. I can say, hey, you're going to follow me for today. You know, go take a history from this patient. Go listen to this patient's heart. Don't forget to listen to his chest. You know, when I tell the medical student to do that, it's very easy. It's a no-brainer decision. They're going to go do it, right? But when you don't tell them, They just, a lot of the time, and I used to do this, you just stand there and you wait for something to happen. You wait for someone to tell you to do something.
I do it now, that's why I'm laughing.
And I get it. I was there and that used to be me. And a lot of it is like this huge power dynamic. You feel like you don't belong. You feel like you're not part of the team. Like, I completely get it. And so I'm trying to, you know, eliminate that for at least the medical students that are with me. And I hope if any of them are watching, they will say that I've been a good teacher.
I'm sure you have. What do you do when they come back and then they present your findings? Because there's different types of personalities I've seen with the clinicians.
Sure.
And then what approach do you use? Are you just like, oh, tell me, and then do you correct them at the end, or you're like, you're one of those guys like, wait, okay, so go back.
I mostly just let the student say whatever they want, and I let them go on some super long ramble or tangent if that's where they're going. Because when you go on that ramble or tangent, you know you're going on a ramble or a tangent. And you feel like, oh my God, I'm going on a ramble or a tangent. And I think having that feeling and experiencing it makes you think next time, maybe I should keep it a bit shorter. Maybe I could change this. Maybe I could change that. But all my feedback is usually at the end. And it's almost always going to be lots of good feedback with maybe just one or two things that could be better next time.
You sandwich that in between the...
it's not even about that. The honest truth is that just the experience of presenting is the biggest learning point.
Yeah.
That's it. Whatever little comment I give at the end is like, you know, 10% of the journey of learning this presentation. I'm still learning how to present properly, so I don't expect any medical student to give me a good one. And yeah, it's more of just having fun together. I always say at the beginning, you know, this is a non-stress zone. This is judgment-free. I'm going to ask you a lot of questions. If you don't know, just tell me you don't know. If you have questions, just ask me. And yeah, let's have fun together. Let's learn together. That's what I always say at the very beginning. Hi, my name is Nasser. Get their name, and then that's my speech.
do they like freak out? Like, oh, see, I've seen you.
there's been a little bit of that for sure. Most people just don't say anything until the last day, and they're like, oh yeah, by the way, I watch your videos. And then you have students who like keep coming back every day in the afternoon or every 2 days in the afternoon, and then they finish their elderly care placement. And they still come while they're on their next placement. And sometimes we have to turn people away because, you know, we already have medical students.
Yeah.
Or we're too busy or whatever. But rarely. I hate turning away people, medical students, because we're busy. I think we've done it once.
You're an agreeable personality, a very agreeable one.
Like, agreeable one.
Yeah, and like conflict averse. Would I say that? Can I say that? I don't know.
If I get into conflict with people?
Like, for example, what you said now.
Yeah.
Like, I feel bad telling someone to go away.
Mm.
Like, yeah, that kind of situation.
I think my level of feeling bad won't stop me from telling someone to go away.
Okay.
If I need to. But I still feel that emotion, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think the overarching, quote-unquote, correct thing to do is still what I will do. But I'll feel bad in the process if it's a situation like that.
I'm like that as well.
Yeah,
I'm very conflict averse. Like when there's a conversation that's hard to be had, I kind of like delay it a bit. And I'm like, and at the end, I'm like, okay, now I have to do it and just commit to it.
Like, I wouldn't quite say that I'm like that. I think I'm probably more confrontational than most.
Okay.
But my threshold for being confrontational might not be as low as someone else. You know, I brush a lot of things off my shoulder because I just don't care enough. And like, you know, like there's so many things that I feel like can upset you on a day-to-day basis, and so many like comments people, friends, colleagues can make that might like rub you the wrong way. But like the threshold for me to care is really high. You know, I have to really care. And so most things I just brush off. But if something needs to be said, then you'll say it.
It used to be more like that when I was younger. Mm. Now, as I grow up, I think I'm becoming more sensitive. I don't know why.
Me too.
It's an interesting thing. Like, I'm becoming more sensitive. And I'm like, no, I don't want to care so much.
Yeah. I feel like I'm much more easily, like, I cry a lot more in emotional movies and things like that. Where,
same.
When I was a kid,
same.
You couldn't catch me shedding a tear, you know?
Before I go
out. Now I'm like trying to hold back my tears every movie I watch. And I'm like, this isn't even sad. What? I feel like crying.
I think it's you realizing, I don't know. You kind of realize the reality of the world we're living in and like life. Maybe I don't know.
I'm just becoming soft with age.
With me, I
my
never
speed cred.
My like I think when I was in high school, never cried. Like I was a kid, like I was like whatever happened, like there was this even in very bad situations, like I remember like this situation, I was like, there's something wrong with me.
Mm.
Like why am I not crying?
Yeah.
And then after that, years pass by and now exactly like you. I cry with movies and I'm like, and my sister, this is the funny thing, my sister looks at me and she's like,
why are you
what?
Crying?
Yeah. And it's my sister who cried in every...
I know the feeling.
Anyways. Yeah, I live with my sisters too, which is kind of cute.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Is she your twin by any chance?
No. You know, when I called called my fiance yesterday, but told her I was going to have this conversation with you. And I was like, I watched his video and we have so much in common. Like, he plays basketball. I play basketball. It's like, he snowboards. I snowboard too. It's like, I was getting excited. It's like, oh, he has a broken front tooth here. And I was like, I have a broken front tooth too. Like, in the exact same tooth. I had it in an accident anyway. And I was like, I was like freaking out. Yeah. And then Marina was like, she was like, yeah, I guess the only difference is that in 5 years, he's going to have hair and you're not.
You've got those Greek genes. You're gonna start balding real soon.
My dad's bald as well, so I'm like,
all my Greek friends are balding as well.
It's sad. You know,
I'm too hairy. If anything,
one other thing that I'm not gonna do is, you know, when people leave it and you get the island
you
thing,
get the side thing. I
don't want to do
you'll
that.
You'll go straight to Turkey. You'll get a you'll come back.
I found out people do this now here. Like, they go to Turkey and they do the hair. They also do other jobs.
Yeah,
like,
it's very common. You can do your veneers, your teeth as well. Yeah.
I saw in the subway where you see it, like, come to Istanbul and do this. And like, it was like, if you don't smile back, come to Istanbul and like do your thing. I was like, why?
You can do a lot of that.
I've got some more serious questions.
You're going to start emotional again. So,
I've got a few here. Let's go for, I will give up my life for my career, or like the other thing you hear, medicine is not a job, it's a lifestyle, it's a vocation. Taking in mind the long and many unsociable hours, going beyond schedule, do you consider that to be true?
Okay, repeat the question so I make sure I understood it.
So, people say, when you go into medicine, I'm giving up my life, like, for my career. And it's not like a 9-to-5 job. It's like, it's a lifestyle. Like, your life is built around your job. It's not there. It's not my life and then my job is on the side. And I guess many people now want to have their job, don't want their job to be the central part of their life. So what I'm asking is that true? Does medicine take that central role in your life?
Yeah, I think, so obviously I'm an F1 doctor. I've only been working for 4 months.
Taking that in
mind. Disclaimer. But yeah, from what I've seen and what I understand, you know, a career in medicine is definitely a lot more involved in your life long term, you know, looking over the next 30, 40 years, as opposed to some other jobs or some other common jobs that you might have. And a lot of it is, you know, you need tons of hours to learn, to become more knowledgeable, et cetera, to tick all the boxes for your certification of training, for making sure that your knowledge is up to date with the exams you have to do every couple of years, with your registration and whatever. And also the unsociable hours. You know, I feel like if you work long hours, having said that, people in law, people in finance work probably even worse hours than a lot of doctors. But that in combination with unsociable hours, so working nights, working twilight shifts, working in the evenings, I feel like at least makes it feel like medicine is a much bigger part of your life than another job might be. As far as how I feel about that, I personally think that I would become really bored doing any one thing for the rest of my life. And I think if medicine was to be the entirety of my life for the rest of my life, I would become bored. I enjoy the job so much, genuinely. I was driving to work the other day thinking like about how excited I am to go and like see my colleagues and go talk to patients and like do all this fun stuff. I was genuinely thinking that in the car. So I love the job. But I think if it was the only thing I did in my life, it would become boring. And so, you know, having that balance with hobbies, with, you know, socializing with your friends, with your sports, with maybe other passion projects that you have, whether that be something business related or not, if it's just drawing, if it's, you know, walking with your friends in the park, like whatever it is, just having something else that you're passionate about, I think is really important. And I think anyone, I mean, there will be very, very committed people to medicine, which is completely fair enough, obviously. If that's what makes you happy, like, good for you. And that's an entirely reasonable point of view and viewpoint, and I have nothing bad to say about it. But for me personally, I think that I would need something else that I'm very passionate about in my life in order to keep the medicine being fun long term. You know, I've been working for 4 months. Talk to me in 5 years, talk to me in 10 years. I might feel very different about what my day-to-day job looks like. Mm. I probably will. And so I'm trying to keep other things alive in my life as well as medicine. Yeah, that's my long-winded answer to your question.
No, I feel like that too. Like when I think of myself in like 20, 30 years, I want to be able to, you know, I want to have a family. I want to have a life outside medicine. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that, you know, I kind of ruminate about when I'm like thinking about what specialty to pick.
Yeah. Yeah, same for sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you did you grow up in Greece?
Grew up in Cyprus. So Cyprus, I'm not actually from...
Very similar person.
One post. Do you mind if we close the aircon?
Yeah, go for it. Are you cold?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
Are you going to get hot?
No, it's fine, it's fine. I mean, my face will become a bit more red, but it doesn't matter.
Do you want... we can just put it a bit up. Okay.
No, I don't mind.
If you get hot, we'll just...
Leave it, it's fine.
Sorry, yeah.
you're freezing, yeah. Where were we talking about?
Specialty. So I'm like ruminating about specialty because I want to see like how my...
Yeah. Now, I was asking you if you grew up in Greece. You said Cyprus, so which works just as well. You'll know from having grown up in Cyprus that the culture there, like in Greece where I grew up and in the Arab world where I'm from, that a doctor is a god. You know, whatever the doctor says goes.
Yeah.
And doctors are, you know, people who you thank 100 times before you leave their office. You kiss the ground they walk on and you say, thank you so much for seeing me, for like taking the time, blah, blah, blah. And I feel like some people in the UK and in, you know, the more Western world have this belief that, you know, doctors, it's a vocation. It's not a job. You know, it's something that they do because that is their destiny, and you know their entire job is to take care of other people. Their mental health isn't as important, their physical health isn't as important, their job is for the patient, their job is to take care of the patient, which I think is a really harmful position to put doctors in. And I think, you know, the general public and people in other professions need to understand and respect that doctors, with the huge responsibility that they carry and with all the amazing things that they do, they are just normal people like you and me at the end of the day. And, you know, they're not this superhuman who's immune to any mental health or physical health problems. and you know, they deserve the same rest, the same ups and downs and difficulties that someone in any other career deserves. They're not a superhuman god, as a lot of people might look up to them, and as I did when I was younger. I think people need to cut doctors a little bit of slack. You can care immensely for your patients and you can do an incredible job and at the same time have your work be your work. Those two things can coexist. It's not one or the other. And I think that's really important for people to understand.
I think social media and like the whole internet thing is making this a bit, it's kind of fading this away, this idea that you described. It's making doctors and seem more human. Like, I don't know if you, Dr. Glockham Fleck, you probably watch
him. Yeah, I love him.
Yeah, so he's like, he's an ophthalmologist. He does it, but then he just does comedy on the side. Mm. And then there's other doctors like on YouTube as well, like you, which it's, you're normalizing it a bit and be like, look, I'm a person with other interests as well. I do other stuff as well. Like I snowboard. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's going to help in that kind of.
Yeah,
aspect.
I mean, I think that stigma is largely breaking down, but you still do get a lot of people, I think, especially in the older generations, who kind of have that feeling of, you know, your job is to just treat me and make sure I'm better. Like, how dare you not spend 100 hours with me and make sure that everything is okay and this and that. Like, look, it's okay. Some people come from older generations where that was normal and that's how they grew up and whatever. There's nothing I can do about that. And I don't necessarily blame them for feeling that way. But I think, as you mentioned, a lot of that thinking is changing and it's not our responsibility, but part of what we do and the good that we put out there with the videos and the things that we do and make is a bit of breaking down that stigma of, you know, doctors can still be respectful, polite, hardworking, dedicated to their patients, but normal people at the same time.
I hope these podcasts can help as well, because in a podcast, you get to break down a bit someone's character, like how they react, etc.
Yeah.
And then I used to also ask people, like, I've stopped doing it now, that okay. often, but like, what movie do you like and stuff like that? And you're just like, oh, my doctor watches movies.
isn't that strange though that you think, oh, my doctor watches movies? Like, what did you think they were doing? Are they sleeping in the hospital? Like, they're sleeping with the patient, you know, making sure they're okay.
You charge them at night and then they wake up the next day.
It's like plug them into the wall and charge them.
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully that doesn't happen sometime. Because you always need like, you need the person's touch, a person's like, mm-hmm. it's another thing, like, yeah. That's why I think the role of a doctor or the role of a person in any job, not only in the medical field, the compassion that a person can convey, there's some studies on this, and like, we've got some stuff coming up, stay tuned. How important it is, like science-based, like if you touch a patient, that actually, when you talk to them, in a compassionate way, of course, and that kind of increases the chances of their treatment going well, like significantly.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
I believe it entirely, yeah. The placebo effect is very real. Yeah, absolutely. If you think you're receiving good care, your body will think you're receiving good care, and you can get better than you would should you think you're receiving bad care with the same medication. So yeah, absolutely.
I think this overlaps with the kind of the positivity kind of mindset, that there's someone out there that cares for me and wants me to be good, like knows me to get better. I guess that helps in all things around in life,
for
I guess.
Sure. Just imagine you're sitting in a hospital bed and you're thinking, you know, wow, like everyone here is so nice to me. Like they're really treating me well. Like, oh, I hope that medication that they're trying today is going to work. You know, like there's some sun in here, there's some good food. Like, oh, I'm feeling hopeful, right? If you're a patient and you're feeling like that versus a patient feeling, oh God, like, why has no one come to see me yet? And no one's treating me well. I hate the nursing staff here. I hate this. I hate that. You know, those two viewpoints, I think, would severely impact your recovery. And it's been shown time and time again how powerful it is, the thought that you're getting treatment, the thought that you're getting good treatment. I mean, it makes perfect sense.
I think this also plays with catastrophizing, which is the process of, just to give a little in context, is the process of, I have a bad thought, and then I kind of make that worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm going to die because, I don't know, because I had a splinter in my finger. Oh, I'm bleeding, all this, and there's nobody cares, nobody loves me, you know. And it kind of, you start catastrophizing. And I'm sure all of us have gone through the process of something small happens, and then we start, everything's breaking down. But yeah, that's true. I want to go to another question now. What's some stats here as well?
Took a stats course. I got this.
How old are you? You did.
I'm 27 now.
27. See, the other foundation year doctors, how old are they?
If they went to medical school straight from high school, they'll be 23.
Do you feel there's a gap between like? Yeah.
Huge.
Huge.
I'm a much different person now than I was 4 years ago.
Of course, same thing.
For sure. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure you felt that in medical school as well.
Yeah. I already knew how to study. I was very confident in myself. I had a very good group of friends around me. I had already taken like 100 exams by the time I sat my first medical school
exam. I'm a pro now.
You know, it didn't faze me. I was like, just going to study, just going to do the exam. I'll probably do well. See, if I don't, it's fine.
You know? That's a success factor, though, in the YouTube thing. Because maybe you already had everything, like you already knew how to study, etc. And then you're
100%. I mean, there are a million things that went perfectly right for my YouTube channel to, you know, gain the amount of viewership and success that it did. For sure. That's like
crazy.
Extremely lucky combination of many different things.
I felt that in first year as well. Like I've heard of in first year I did the military. So in Cyprus we have conscription. I did an extra year of school, I think, because I went to do A-levels.
Okay.
And so I did that as well. And then I did military. And then I came here and I was about 2-3 years older than the other people. And I felt that difference.
It's huge.
And I hanged out with post-grads. Like another Cypriot. So I did military with them, which is pretty fun. But now I feel that, now that difference, I don't feel it anymore.
Yeah. As you grow older, that the feeling of that difference shrinks for sure.
Yeah.
When I was 22 and my classmates were 18, that was a very big difference, you know, when I started here in Kings.
Yeah.
That's a very, very big difference. I mean, I'm sure you guys remember what it's like to be 18. How old are you guys now?
Two.
Okay, perfect.
24.
Think hard.
Probably, yeah. So yeah, I'll get corrected.
Obviously, a lot has changed in that time.
Yeah. Let's go to the stats. So, which one should we do? I got transition from, so it's 6:56.
Yeah.
Just
hear me.
Yeah. We could do the transition from medical school to foundation year or workplace bullying. Which one do you want to do?
How is this a stats question?
It will become a stats question.
Hit me with the transition.
Okay. So how was transition from medical to FY1? Mm. Did you feel prepared for it, thrown in the ocean, that whole thing? Mm-hmm. And now I've got some. So this study published in 2022. This is by Moore et al. I like seeing the names because we give credit to the people that did the study. During the COVID pandemic, a new position was created for it was called the Interim Foundation Year 1 program.
Yeah, I remember it. My friends did it.
Amazing. So I don't even have to. So this was the final medical students. 4,500 were enrolled in this. They were paired with a senior buddy. They had the same responsibilities as a foundation year one doctor. They got paid the same. Mm. They were insured by the GMC. And then they found that this whole cohort kind of helped them increase their self-perceived preparedness and also lower the anxiety.
Yeah.
And these guys also found that a lot of the foundation year doctors that didn't do this program that were going into foundation year were actually had anxiety levels which are pathologically high, which means... These are the anxiety levels for the people that go into become a foundation year doctors.
Without this intern training.
Yeah,
I can relate to that. I'll comment on that in a second.
So, but pathological means that, like, they need intervention.
Inappropriate, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, go on. What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm not surprised at those findings at all. The critical thing to understand with the transition from final year medical student to doctor is that it literally goes like this, okay? And on your last day of medical school, when you're a final year medical student, you are in the exact same place, surrounded by the exact same people, okay? Looking at the same patients, blah, 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 except you have zero responsibility. Nothing, all right? Mm-hmm. If you don't do anything, it's going to be fine. Nothing's going to happen. All right. You're not required to take those bloods. You're not required to make a decision. You're not required to make a diagnosis, whatever. That's your final day of medical school. And then 2 months later, you're in the exact same position, except you have all the responsibility, right? And so that jump is huge, okay? It's not to be underestimated. It's not to be, downplayed or anything like that. And I feel like you certainly feel that responsibility. Now, the important thing is what support networks you have in place, okay? So take any F1 doctor and put them in the role of an F1 on their very first day, on their very first job, and they're going to be completely lost, okay? Mm. No matter how active they were in medical school, how much they studied, and, you know, you can take me as an example of someone who was further along the spectrum of a hardworking studying student who attended placement most days, like I am on that side of the spectrum, okay?
Yeah.
I won't say I was the nerdiest kid who studied the hardest or the most, because I wasn't, but I'm far on that side of the spectrum compared to the other side, okay?
Yeah.
And I was a fish out of the water when I started my F1 job.
So imagine the guy on the other side.
So there's a whole spectrum of other people, okay, who are not on that side, who might have had a harder time than me, who might have had an easier time than me, whatever. The point that I'm trying to make is, even for someone who was a very high achiever in medical school, myself, okay, it was still a huge transition. The important thing that helps make or break that experience is your support network, who you're surrounded by, how much help they give you, how much they nurture you, how much whatever. Mm. So generally speaking, if you're in a like big tertiary center like the one that we're in central London, it's a very large teaching hospital, etc., you'll have more seniors and more support than you might if you are in a district general hospital further outside of London, where it's a lot smaller. And there isn't as much staffing, for example. And so to give you my experience and my example, I was surrounded by several doctors of all grades, SHOs, junior clinical fellows, registrars, and consultants, who have all been absolutely wonderful in terms of creating an open environment where I could ask questions without feeling judged. And, you know, were always willing to listen to me and to help me. And if I was concerned about a patient or a decision or whatever, I never thought twice about asking and saying, hey, guys, I don't know what to do here. Like, can you please help me? And that's been amazing. And I feel like without that, this could have been a very different conversation and a very different experience. And I'm sure there's a lot of my F1 colleagues who have gone through, you know, a situation where they didn't have that support, where they may have been belittled or bullied or made to feel like they can't be as open talking to or seeking support, rather, which is horrible. And, you know, that's not a fun experience to be in. But so much of your experience is made up from that, I think. And no matter how much you prepare in medical school, you have to actually do the job to find out what it's like. You know, I reached a point in my final year of medical school where I'd gone to placement so much, I had taken so many exams, I had taken so many histories, I had done so many bloods, and I was like, okay, like, this is it. I've completed the medical school experience. Mm-hmm. Anything else that I need to learn or responsibility that I need to have, I need to have the responsibility. I need to have title doctor next to my name, and it needs to be my responsibility that this stuff gets done. That's how I'm going to learn more. That's the next step that I need to take.
You saturated that, and then you're like, okay, what's the next step? Give me the responsibility, and that's how I'm going to learn.
Exactly. By the end of medical school, I had saturated the experience of being a medical student. Mm-hmm. For sure.
So if you had actually attended this interim foundation year program, I guess that would have helped.
Wow, I went on the longest tangent ever. Sorry, back to that question.
it was, to be honest, my question was a bit too long. That's the one thing I have to, I should have shortened that down.
Tangent.
No, it was very, yeah.
But I think I started my answer by saying that I completely agree with what was said there. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that you have to actually do the job, okay? So those F1s who did the interim F1 thing, they started working 4 months before the traditional F1s, right? Mm-hmm. In those 4 months, they will have learned the exact same thing as the F1 starting at the normal time would learn in their 4 months. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Doesn't actually matter where that teaching was. It's just about the time. It's just about the experience. Like, the first time you see a patient alone, your anxiety is going to be here. And the 10th time it's going to be here, and the 100th time it's going to be here.
So it's not like it was just pushed repetition. A bit further.
Exactly. It's the same thing, is just pushed a bit further back.
Okay.
In my opinion, I think that you just have to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's one of those things. And you have to take the leap, take the jump, and
And hope personally, for the best. I feel that it's all about repetition. You know, like on our ward, the first time the crash bell got called. You know, I was shitting myself. I was like, what the hell do I do? Like, where do I go? Like, what am I supposed to do when I show up? You know, we had run through ATE in medical school 100 times.
Yeah.
But the first time it got cold, I did not know what to do.
What happened?
I was shocked.
Did you go there and you were like, hey, airway?
Well, you know, I had my colleagues there who were much more senior than me, and they immediately got to work and started doing things. And I was just there, like, you know, really, really shocked. And, you know, 40, 50 crash bell calls later, you know, I approached the situation with a lot more calmness. I feel like I still don't know exactly what to do, and I certainly don't run the whole thing. But I just feel a bit more confident. I feel a bit more in place. I've done some of those things before. So it's the same thing, you know, first time crash bell gets called, I'm very, very anxious. 10th time, I'm not that anxious. 50th time, I feel a lot better. And so it's just about experience.
Yeah. I guess, no, you're right. You just have to do it. There's no other formula to it. You do it, you learn, and then you do it 50 times, you become better at it.
Exactly.
So like, yeah, I get that.
Repetition is key.
Can you make it through foundation year without coffee?
I have a lot of colleagues who don't drink coffee, who don't drink tea. Maybe they have like a Pepsi. Some of them don't have it at all. So you can. I don't know how.
I don't understand these people.
I have coffee throughout the whole day. Like, they have those little instant coffee things in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Which suck, just for the record. They suck.
You have an acquired taste for coffee.
But like, they're not even.
Not even.
It's just they're that bad. But there's no good alternative. And
you just down it.
To be honest, like, it doesn't really matter what I'm drinking. I just want something hot to do this motion with. Like, you know, that's all I need. I need something to, like, fidget with, something to drink, something just to make me feel like I'm being fueled.
Yeah. You
know? It doesn't matter. If you replaced it with probably, like,
a grape juice.
Stuffed animal and I just did this motion, I would probably get the same effect. Genuinely, like, it's just a habit. It's just a thing that, like, I believe makes me work better and more focused.
Placebo effect?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe. Back to the placebo. Yeah.
I was listening. I don't drink coffee, by the way. I drink it, you know. It's not like I'm like, I'll drink it as a... And I was listening to the Huberman podcast yesterday. He did another episode for coffee. Okay. And he was just going on about all the positive things that coffee can do for you. Mm. It's like amazing for your... I'm not going to quote him, but yeah, you could just go listen to the podcast. Very nice podcast. Mm. And then he talked about the fact that coffee is a positive reinforcer. Mm. So whatever you're doing at that time, it reinforces that idea and it makes you like that idea. So for example, if you're having coffee now with me and you're sitting and having a conversation, there's
Do I like you more?
Yes. So my plan so the whole time. You And he says the motion of holding a cup and bringing it to your mouth and that you like that motion and you feel it's exactly what you described here. You were 100%. Saying, and I was like, yes, like that's what he was talking about.
100%.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just going to get really nerdy, but the power of social cues and environmental cues to, you know, get yourself in a certain mindset or a certain zone, whether that's a study zone, a fun zone, a relaxed zone, whatever, is so underestimated. I mean, you can take anything. It honestly does not matter what it is. And you can associate it with some particular activity that you do. You know, some common things you might have heard are chewing gum while taking an exam. If you only chew gum when you take an exam, then next time you chew gum, you're going to be in that mindset and in that zone of chewing gum, of writing an exam.
Yeah.
And you can do this with anything, absolutely anything. I mean, you can change the lights of the colors in your room. You can change the position of different objects on your desk for when you're studying, for when you're relaxing, for when you're doing this. You can make it up as you go along, okay? you just have to believe that it's working, and you have to commit to the thing that you're doing, and it will work. It will make a difference. Genuinely. Atomic Habits is the book I was quoting all these things from.
I was about to say that because I've read that book as well, and I was like,
So when I read Atomic Habits, I was like, wow, I've been doing these things my whole life. I just didn't have a name for them.
Yeah. You feel that somebody...
Yeah, it felt really good.
No, you're right. And one of the things that he says in Atomic Habits is the environment plays such a role in everything. Like, and I got this and I wrote this down. And one of the things that's coming up about like hospitals. Like if a patient that the studies on this, there's green around him. Like there's some wards here that have it. You get better outcomes, better patient care outcomes, just because there's a tree on the wall and they just feel like they're outside. They're not in a, like...
Yeah. It's absolutely 100% true, yeah.
Do you want to continue?
Yeah, hit me, man.
Yeah? Okay. So,
Are you bored yet?
I'm loving it as well, so yeah, it's going good. So, workplace bullying.
Uh-huh.
So, does it happen? And how easy is it to raise concerns? There was a study published by Chandler et al. In the Sage Journal, 2019. Mm. Surveyed 450 foundation year doctors in the UK and Ireland. 39% reported that they had been bullied. 26 by more senior doctors, 10% by nurses, 2 by managers, 1 by patient, 3 by peers, and 8 more by one more person. So going back to the question.
Yeah.
Does it happen? Are you surprised by these results? And how easy is it to raise concerns? A lot to take in there, sorry.
No, it's fine. I think workplace bullying is definitely a thing that does happen. I can very easily see and imagine a million scenarios where it could happen. I think it's important that I say that I haven't personally experienced it in this first rotation that I've done. And so, you know, I won't be talking from personal experience for a lot of this. But again, this comes back to something I said before, that when I feel that I'm able to ask questions freely to my seniors and I'm able to reach out to them for support and I'm able to say to them, I'm sorry, I don't know, can you help me? if that did not exist, okay, like life would be very, very difficult, okay? Mm. And I can very easily see scenarios because, you know, I've worked with difficult people. I've had difficult conversations on the phone with other colleagues, and I'll talk about those in a second. But if I found myself in a scenario where I knew that if I asked someone a question, I would be ridiculed or I would be made to feel stupid or inferior or whatever, that would make raising those concerns very, very difficult. And obviously, the right thing to do is to raise those concerns because at the end of the day, you're dealing with patients, you're dealing with, you know, things that are really important. But if it's hard to raise those concerns, you know, it'll take a toll on you, on your mental health, on whatever. And although I haven't personally faced or experienced any workplace bullying, I've just had some absurd conversations with colleagues. Most of the time over the phone, I tend to be a so, you know, in your day to day as a doctor, you spend a lot of time on the phone, like a lot of time. And it's almost always calling other specialties and asking for their advice. So a neurologist, a rheumatologist, a cardiologist, a gastroenterologist, and saying, hey, I have this patient, blah, 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 blah. What do you think? Or what's your advice on this? Or can you look at this scan or whatever? So you spend a lot of time talking to people on the phone. And I've just had some absurd encounters. I mean, I was once, I picked up the phone, I said, you know, hi, good afternoon, my name is Nasser. The guy's like, cardiology registrar, like, what's up? And I was like, oh, like, how are you doing today? Very brief, like, quickest question before I got into my main question about the patient. And they're like, I said something along the lines of, do you want me to tell you how I really feel, or do you want me to tell you something just to make you feel better? And I was like,
that's like a punch in the stomach.
All right. It's like, cool, cool. No problem, man. We can just get right into the story, you know? And just, you know, interactions along those lines where when I close the call, I think to myself, like, God, like, how miserable do you have to be to talk to someone on the phone like that? Like, you know, I start every call with good morning. I end it with thank you so much for your time. You know, I try to have a bit of fun engagement when I'm talking to someone on the phone, just out of politeness, nothing else really. And yeah, it rubs me the wrong way when people are so just like rude or miserable or short. You know, we're all working towards the same goal. I'm not calling you for fun to waste your time. I'm calling you because I'm concerned and I have a question and you're the specialist in this field, right? So, and you know, I think even if, you know, as F1s, you have a higher percentage chance of calling someone and wasting their time with a question that might not be valid or that you could have asked someone else or that you weren't prepared for. It happens. But, you know, I think as a senior, you should take that opportunity to explain what might have gone wrong, like what you can do next time. Like shouting at an F1 for doing that is just stupid. But it happens. It happens. So anyways, I went on a very long tangent. We were talking about workplace bullying. So yeah, it does happen. I haven't personally experienced it myself.
But not, I think this is part of it. It might not be bullying, but...
Yeah, like, look.
It's a lack of compassion.
So look, different people would take it a different way, okay? I can... You bush. I know people who would, you know, have heard that response and their entire day would be ruined. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily blame them for that. You know, people take these things in different ways and are more sensitive or to different things. Personally... I don't know this person. I don't care enough to get angry or upset about it. I was just a bit stunned when it happened and I laughed about it with my colleagues. But yeah, certainly, you know, depending on the person on the receiving end of the phone, you can take it in a very different way.
I agree. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So moving on, do you know what Crown Indemnity is?
Crown Indemnity.
You know what that means? This is not me testing you. I don't know either.
That's okay.
So
don't feel embarrassed.
92% of foundation year doctors don't know what it is. It basically, it's from the same study. It means that your employing NHS trust will be liable for any claim made by the patient treated by you, which is pretty interesting. And it's just random fact I just had.
Yeah. So my consultant is a very, very lovely gentleman. And he has a lot of experience in going to court for a million different things regarding the patients that he's looked after and, you know, complaints that have been made by the families and whatever, because his name is, you know, the consultant's name is always attached to each patient. So if anyone in the chain of command makes a mistake, like the consultant always has to answer for it. Anyways, so, you know, he tells us that you know, the vast majority of the time, the NHS always settles with whoever's making the complaint.
So they give them money, basically.
Yeah, because apparently it's a lot cheaper than dragging out the situation for a long time. But yes, I did know that. I just didn't know that was the name.
Doesn't send a good vibe to people, though. That means
I mean, it's
I'll
really,
sue the NHS and they'll give them money just so.
It's the practicalities of the situation. I don't think. It should not reflect, I think, negatively or positively against the NHS. It's just this is the reality of the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've done all that. Should we do it to last 15 minutes? Do some more personal questions. So she. what advice have your parents given you that you hold dear to your heart?
Wow. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
If somebody asked me that question, I would be like, oof, no, oh, wow, so much.
That's a good one. Probably what sticks out the most in my mind, probably because of how many times I've heard it, is my dad always saying to me something along the lines of, get your priorities straight. Or set your priorities correctly. And he would always say this when he thought I was not studying enough and going out and having fun and blah, 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 you know, like dads always do. And the truth is, I was always studying. So there was no need for this. But no, the underlying message is just that, you know, whatever your priorities are, whether that's getting A-star grades throughout university or getting grades that you are happy with, that you feel comfortable with, whether that's like A's, B's, C's, whatever, and spending your time on your family, on your friends, on partying and social life, if that's what's really important to you, fair enough. You know, everyone will have their own, their own set of priorities. And I think you just need to figure out what that is and make sure that you get it done within the constraints of the real world, which is, if I want to be a doctor, I need to get a certain amount of grades. I need to have a certain amount of work experience. And so if grades and work experience are not your priority, but your priority is to be a doctor, that doesn't necessarily align. So within the constraints of the real world, figure out what you actually need to do and sort of the minimum that you need to achieve in order to get to where you want to be. And then prioritize your life accordingly and do the things that you actually find fun, that you enjoy, that will keep you going.
And that's good advice. Set your house straight in order.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Focus on the important things.
Mm. What advice would you give to any medical students?
I feel like it's so hard looking back to give advice because I feel mentally so far away from it. And the truth is I generally found medical school a relatively, you know, simple and continuous process. There were obviously times that were a lot more challenging, a lot more difficult, like exam periods, final year was particularly busy. But generally speaking, you know, I tackled most parts of medical school in the same way, which was, what do I need to do? How am I going to do it? How much time is this going to take? And like, you know, here's my schedule. Let me put this time block here. Let me put this time block there. And I found that trying to break down my obstacles and my tasks and my to-do lists and whatever into smaller and smaller pieces until it was easy to sort of think about and conceptualize made my time throughout medical school very simple because everything was the same. It didn't matter if it was an essay or a tutorial worksheet or my final exam or the SJT. They could all be broken down into smaller and smaller and smaller steps, and each one of those small steps could be completed in a certain amount of time. I could just put that time into one of my weekdays, you know. So I think medical school can feel very overwhelming, especially if you think about the big picture, because there is a lot to do. But every single one of those things can be broken down. And I think if you sit there with a pen and paper and you break it down, your life will become so much easier because you know you can complete every individual part of that bigger, you know, task, whatever it is. So break things down into smaller pieces, I guess, is my advice.
I think that would also help people with stress because when you have a lot of stuff to do, it's like it just seems impossible. Like, how am I ever going to do this?
Yeah.
And then you, like you said, you break it down into simple steps and then you're like, I can actually do this now. And then the next thing, oh, I'm done with this. Move on to the next
100%.
Thing. Step by step, like do this, number one, number two, number three, and you'll get there. Like,
and just offload, like take things out of your head and out of your mind, put them on a piece of paper.
That helps so
write
much.
Them into Notion. Fucking talk to your friend about it, whatever. Like, just get it. So many people, they sit there with 100 things going on that's stressing them out, and they just keep them all in their head, you know? That's not going to help. Like, just take it out of your head, put it on a piece of paper, put it on something you can actually see, and then that relieves mental space from you. And then you know what you need to do, and you can break each one of those tasks down into smaller tasks. And it, for me, it becomes so much simpler. But just sitting there being stressed is not going to help, you know? Just write things down, talk to someone. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I feel the same thing. Like whenever I'm like, I catch myself being stressed about things. I'm like, oh no, I have to do this, I have to do this. I'm like, okay, relax, sit down. Take a piece of paper, or I open my notes on my iPhone. I'm like,
yeah, literally,
I've got a note that's always there. It's called tasks.
And stress.
it's like, open this in case of, and I open it up and I'm like, I've got quick tasks and like long-term tasks. And I just put everything there. And once I've done that, I stop ruminating about it. And I stop like,
exactly.
I like there's this nice analogy. I don't remember where I heard this about. It's like a cow. Cows, when they eat food, they have they do it like 7 times. They digest it 7 times. That's how the human brain works sometimes. Like before you go to sleep, you just ruminate and ruminate. You chew on the same information constantly.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah,
it's very true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What else? I think that kind of brings us to the end of it. Okay. One last one, and then.
One more cheeky.
One more. What does self-compassion mean to you?
Self-compassion?
As you've realized, I like the word compassion.
All right. I think I've only really understood self-care in recent times. Since actually from when I started doing therapy in the end of my fourth year of medical school. I think before then, I didn't realize that sometimes I had to just sit there and think about what was going on in my life in order to truly digest it and understand it and have a think about what can I be doing better, what can help me in this situation. Before that, I was just go, and I didn't think about any of this stuff. I didn't have any self-compassion. It doesn't matter if you want to go to the gym or not. In your schedule it says go to the gym, so you're going to the gym. You know, it doesn't matter if you want to play video games right now. Your exam is on Wednesday and you still have 3 chapters to do, so you're going to do 1 chapter today. There was no weighing up. There was no balancing involved. It was very simple. I just had flow charts that I followed, and my decision making was extremely, you know, binary. It was very logical. And I didn't understand what it meant to sit there and reflect on how I felt about all those things. And so self-compassion for me now means taking the time to actually check in with myself and say, like, Nasser, how do you feel this evening, right? I know you said you were going to go to the gym, but actually, do you think maybe sitting down to watch a movie would be better for you in 2 hours from now? And then, you know, taking the time to think about that decision and weigh up the pros and cons and be like, you know what? Fuck it, I'm going to sit down and watch a movie today.
Yeah.
Which is something I would have never dreamed of, you know, a couple of years ago. You know, having that ability to check in with myself and ask myself, how are you doing? That's what I feel like self-compassion is for me.
Yeah.
And I try to do that as much as I can now. I'm certainly a lot better at it than I used to be, but there's a long way to go as well. But I'm working on it, one step at a time.
I feel that too. I think one thing that's helped me do that, because I don't know, I'm sure it's you kind of relate to this as well, and you, Simone, like your day is just filled with stuff. Like it's one thing after the other. And it just doesn't allow you to just, like you said, take a step back and say, how do I actually feel about what I'm doing? Mm. How do I actually feel about my program today? About what I'm about to do? You don't ask yourself that. You just do it. Like you're just a machine. Do this.
It's very true.
And then I was like, recently I've started doing this, and like before I go to bed, I just have some time where I just don't do anything. Like I kind of dim the lights and I just sit on my bed and I just think about how I'm feeling.
Yeah.
And it's weird.
Which is really
and
really powerful to me.
And honest, you know what? Sometimes at the beginning I was like, I just felt weird. What am I doing? Just, you know, like just sitting by myself and just thinking. Like, because you don't usually do it. You never actually think about this stuff.
It's very true.
Yeah.
Some people are really good at this, and not to overgeneralize, but I feel like generally speaking, at least from the experiences I've had in my life, women tend to be better at this. And I think, you know, my girlfriend is an excellent example. And another great example is Kenji, who was a colleague of mine who went to medical school with me. He also has a YouTube channel. And their ability to think about how they feel and reflect on situations is just unbelievable. I mean, I could never dream of reaching that level of depth and reflection in my own life. And so I learn a lot from them, and I try to take into account the types of things that they do and think about. I think they're just a lot more in touch with their feelings and their sense of being. For me, I'm just like, just do the to-do list, like go to work, come back, go have fun, like relax. But I'm trying to change. I'm trying to become better with that, for sure.
Maybe that's why we cry more.
Yeah, maybe. You know, maybe we're improving. we're getting there.
We're getting there. That's the sign that you're in touch with how you feel.
One step at a time.
Yeah.
We'll get there. Yeah.
I think that brings us to the end of it. And
awesome, man.
Thank you. It's been amazing. You're thank you for doing this. I got a good gift for you. Wait,
let me. Got a gift for me?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You did not have to get me a gift.
Don't worry. It was just I was in my house this morning and I was like, I just saw this. And I was like, yeah, I think he's gonna appreciate it. And then I got a gift for Simone as well. He actually is here. So I got gifts for everyone.
Let's have it. It's Oprah.
It's Christmas. It's before it.
What have you bought?
So this is not any. This is not
sponsored.
This is not sponsored. So I'm gonna hide it. This is Greek Cypriot coffee.
Ah, amazing.
So I know you like coffee.
It'll give me a good feeling of home. Thank you so much.
I'm sure you know how to.
Yeah, to make a Turkish coffee, of course.
Yeah.
Or a Greek coffee, as you would say. Yeah.
So, does it smell like home?
No, it doesn't have a thing.
You can open it and just be like, then.
No. We're saving this. It's going in the pot.
And then I got, this is one of my favorite teas.
Wow.
Because this is
very nice.
This is mixed herbal tea. It's from this monastery in Cyprus. Called Timiu Prodromo Mesopotamos. It's lovely tea. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Yeah.
Thank you, Simone.
So yeah, that's about it. Thank you.
Awesome. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe, obviously.
Not yet.
You can't forget that.
Yeah, also don't forget. I don't usually say that. At the end I'm like, consider subscribing.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
Maybe.
Whatever you want to tell me. I'll do it for you, don't worry.
Okay, go for it. Should we do that peace thing that you do?
Yeah, what's
that
thing? I mean, there's three cameras. I don't know.
Let's be like.
Yeah.
Peace.
Yeah, peace. So thank you so much for watching. Have fun. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe. Peace.